Well, beloved listeners, we've been looking at the vicissitudes of Venezuela for quite some time, with intensifying interest, of course, in recent weeks. And, of course, the wider dramas taking place through Latin America in the wake of the so-called Pink Tide. I want to, before I introduce my guests formally, I want to read a couple of pars by one of them from the New York Times. Quote, an African proverb captures the growing concern about a geopolitical showdown between world powers over Venezuela. When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. As in most proxy conflicts, Venezuela is a spoil in a larger prize. For the United States, it represents an opportunity to control the agenda in the region, sideline Russian influence, and ensure that China takes a back seat. In a fight among elephants, it's Venezuelans who stand to lose. But Venezuelans have already lost so much. For years, they've suffered under an economy in free fall and a government in chaos. The scale of the crisis is staggering. An inflation rate that has surpassed 1,000,000%, an historic economic contraction, plummeting oil production, and an exodus of more than 3 million people. Words of Alejandro Velasco, who was one of our guests today. What happens in Venezuela over the next week or so will be critical for its future path, for the region, and for the wider world. The U.S. is expected to employ sanctions on the Venezuelan oil industry next week, and that'll have an even more devastating effect on what's left of the Venezuelan economy. Meanwhile, the interim president, Juan Guaido, has declared himself the leader. Well, he declared himself the leader 2 weeks ago, and he's announced that the first lot of foreign aid has made it through and been distributed to pregnant women. But tensions are rising between his supporters and long-standing President Nicolas Maduro, who is still backed by the military. Now, whatever the outcome, Venezuela's relationships with other countries will be irrevocably changed because the world has had to pick sides. I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Alejandro Velasco. He's Associate Professor of Modern Latin America in the Department of History at New York University. And Javier Carreras is Professor and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College. I welcome you both to our little wireless program. To you first, Alejandro. There are new insights about this coup of sorts came about.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's been some remarkable reporting, especially in the Wall Street Journal and others, about the lead-up to January 23rd, which was the date when Juan Guaido formally announced that he was invoking a constitutional article that grants the National Assembly president executive powers in the event that the presidency is vacated. What we've learned in that reporting is that a notoriously fractious opposition was largely kept out of the loop of negotiations that had been happening among a small group within the opposition, led by Voluntad Popular, Popular Will, which is the party that Juan Guaido comes from, for fears precisely that there would be significant amounts of infighting within this opposition. And so earlier this year, when there was first the idea that perhaps Juan Guaido might invoke this article, it was in fact carried out quite poorly. On January 11th, there was a lot of confusion the day after Maduro was sworn into a new six-year term of office following sham elections last year. And that basically led to a series of 2 weeks where it was really unclear what the opposition was going to do. But by January 23rd, all the stars seemed to have aligned. And when Juan Guaido announced that he was invoking this article, one country after another in Latin America, and then subsequently in Europe, including and also Australia, recognized him as a legitimate president.
I understand that when he crowned himself at that big public rally, there were shocked looks behind him on the podium.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable. Certainly, it's clear that some of the major figures in the opposition who have long been at the center of this political fight domestically were not in on what was going to happen. In fact, one of the major leaders, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, who had run for president against Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, he was completely sidelined from this process, and it was unclear whether he was in fact going to back Guaido. They've all now come into line, but it was a bit stop and go at that moment.
And they were a pretty motley lot, the opposition.
Very much so. They're united in one thing only, and that is, of course, and this has been true for 20 years, to get rid of either Chavez or, since Chavez's death and Nicolas Maduro's presidency, to get rid of Maduro. But within them, there's a tremendous amount of heterogeneity, both ideologically as well as in terms of strategic proclivities in terms of how best to achieve their goal, which has been the case insofar as they've been able to unite conjuncturally, but then the next day is always a bigger problem.
I'm looking at a piece written by David Lunov, and he says here, the plan was largely devised by a group of four opposition leaders, two in exile, one under house arrest and one barred from leaving the country. How extraordinary.
Indeed. And I think one of the more extraordinary elements is that Juan Guaido, who of course now is assuming the mantle of leadership of this opposition, just about a month and a half ago was a virtual unknown, even among the opposition. He was, what I would call sort of a backbencher within one of the larger, but nevertheless not the largest opposition party. And so it's sort of come from nowhere and surprised certainly me and I think other people as well.
Javier, what's your take on these events? Were you surprised like everyone else?
Yes and no. I am surprised for all the reasons that Alejandro has discussed. They kept this a secret for a long time. But there were plenty of signs suggesting that in the past year, opposition to Maduro shifted away from street protests and into the hands of legislators and party leaders. This, in many democracies, always is exactly the kind of scenario that Alejandro describes. It's only a few people strategizing. The details were not known, but there were signs that something was happening at the National Assembly, that they were waiting to act, that they had decided to no longer emphasize street protests, and that they were going to do something on Inauguration Day. The surprise is the boldness of the move, because as Alejandro was saying, what Guaido did on the 23rd of January to basically say that power is now being transferred to the president of the National Assembly was far more extreme than most people were thinking. So, yes, I was surprised, but at the same time, I knew something was going to be happening after January 10th, which is when Maduro's second term in office officially started.
Javier, there's been previous attempts of dispatching Maduro, haven't there?
Yes. All of them produced quite a bit of disarray among the opposition. Although we tend to think that a common enemy unites, the truth is that a common enemy typically disunites, because everyone has a theory on how best to do it. And what has happened is that at this moment of enormous desperation, when somebody decided to take the most extreme position, that tended to be the one that a lot of people were saying, okay, let's go for it. In part, one of the reasons why there was so much disarray before is because the steps taken by leaders were never that extreme, calling for an electoral recount, street protests, but nothing as bold as saying, the president is no longer legitimate, this new guy is the one who is legitimate. And in this moment of enormous desperation, that seemed to have resonated across the entire opposition in Venezuela.
Alejandro, explain to me how a society can survive for 10 minutes when it's got an inflation rate of around 1,000,000%.
Well, yes, that's a great question. And the answer is that for many, the answer is they can't survive. And that's in part why you have seen so many millions of Venezuelans leave the country over the past 2 years. You know, increasingly, not just the middle and upper classes with some wherewithal, but now more, you know, much more popular sectors who are the core basis of support for Maduro and for Chavez before him. But it's a daily struggle. It's a daily struggle to find not only a place that buys the things that you need, but then at a price that you can actually afford. And that means, you know, standing in long lines. That means going to various shops. That means trying to be able to find cash, which is in short supply as well, because prices increase so rapidly. So the answer to your question is with difficulty.
The last time we've seen hyperinflation of that magnitude was, I think, probably in Zimbabwe.
That's correct. Zimbabwe is the example that most immediately comes to mind. You know, people resort to sometimes bartering instead of exchanging currency. Increasingly over the past year or so, what you found is that more and more people accept dollars because the economy has become virtually dollarized as the currency, the domestic currency, loses value and worth. So, of course, that means that if you have some access to dollars, perhaps coming in through remittances or some other kind of route, then you have some staying power. But if you don't, then you rely on the food boxes that the government provides. But of course, that means that you're now much more indebted to the government politically and otherwise.
Now, let's return to the situation so vividly described by Javier. You were in Venezuela, weren't you, Alejandro, in the lead up to this? I think you were there on January the 10th.
Yeah, it turns out that I planned my dates entirely wrong. I arrived on January 10th thinking that, as Javier mentioned, that was going to be the day when most events would unfold. And in fact, it was not only eerily uneventful, but the subsequent days turned out to be kind of duds as well. And then I left on January 22nd, even though as things were heating up, basically expecting that there was going to be, you know, a status quo for the next several months, perhaps even longer. And so, yeah, by the time I landed on the 23rd, I was shocked.
What do we know? I'll put this to you first, Alejandro. What do we know about the interim president, his ideology, his priorities?
Well, we know what he has stated publicly since the 23rd, and what he has stated is that he is prioritizing humanitarian assistance to satisfy the needs of those who are most suffering in Venezuela, that he is prioritizing the, as he calls, the cessation of usurpation by Maduro, that he's prioritizing the establishment of an interim government, and then the calling for new elections when conditions are ripe. In terms of his ideology, it's quite unclear. We have some indication by virtue of his party affiliation. So his party tends to be more centrist. Some of the policies that they have backed, at least in some manifestos and declarations, tend towards some elements of privatizing the economy, especially the certain sectors of the oil industry, incentivizing foreign investment. So it seems to be a much more open market ideology than certainly has been the case over the past 20 years.
Javier, I want to put the same question to you about the shiny, bright new president. He doesn't sound like the same sort of right-wing nut job as the new president in Brazil.
Oh, absolutely not. They're completely different species. Guaido, in addition to all that Alejandro has said, has two interesting aspects. First of all, he comes from the generation of students who were the first ones to really fight hard against Chavez in the late 2000s. So he comes from the student movement, but within that group, he has demonstrated a significant degree of moderation. And the best evidence of that is that even before he assumed presidential powers, he was already talking about transitional justice. He was already talking about anybody who is ready to switch sides will be forgiven. Now, this is very controversial, and he hasn't given us the details. But this is a very different discourse from polarizing punitive approaches that exist within Venezuela. If you talk to almost any human rights activist in Venezuela, they would tell you, you know, this question of transitional justice is really hard for us. But Guaido has taken a very strong stand and to say that, you know, the only way that we can rebuild the country is if we begin with some degree of acceptance of everyone who's willing to join this new movement and avoid a process of punishing wrongdoers. And that, I think, is very remarkable about him and why. And I think that's essentially his current ideology. Who knows what's going to happen later on, but that's where he stands now.
This is Ellie Nell on RN, and we're discussing the vicissitudes of Venezuela. My guests are Javier Corrales, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Amherst, and Alejandro Velasco, Associate Professor of Modern Latin America in the Department of History at New York University. Alejandro, let's go back to the elephants. Who are the principal elephants trampling the grass?
Right. So in the hemisphere, in the Western hemisphere, certainly the United States and to a lesser extent Canada have been, you know, leading the charge in terms of their interest, not only in Venezuela, but more broadly across the region. But elsewhere in the globe, backing Maduro are Russia and China principally, who have each invested billions upon billions of dollars either in credit or in promises of future oil extraction. And also increasingly Turkey over the past 2 years has become a much closer partner to Maduro, especially in terms of sales of gold. So those are the major players that have a lot at stake in Venezuela right now.
And of course, the Trump administration is in a hurry, isn't it, to conclude the process of regime change.
In fact, that's what we're more and more seeing. It seems like the strategy really was a winner-take-all, very rapid blow that would catch, as all of us have been to some extent, but principally the government of Nicolás Maduro, off guard, with the idea that, you know, it would only take just a little bit of a push to fracture the military support behind Maduro. It would only take a little bit of a push to jumpstart major, perhaps street protests by popular sectors that would then be violently repressed. And we haven't seen that. What instead we've seen is Maduro very quickly, I think, learned, perhaps, you know, counseled by Russia or perhaps Cuba, who's also a close ally, that all he really needs to do is wait and win one more day. Because each day that he wakes up in the presidential palace forces an outcome on the part of players, especially the United States, that really had no plan B. And so in the absence of a plan B, the only thing that you have is further escalation. And that's increasingly what we've been seeing. And to the extent that that continues to play out, not only, of course, are Venezuelans going to stand to lose even more because of some of the sanctions that you mentioned before, but the likelihood of a violent outcome becomes greater and greater of a possibility.
Javier, you have a passionate interest in democracy in Latin America. You must be feeling rather glum that democracy is taking such a pounding across the region.
Yes, in that we don't see triumphs of democracy happening everywhere all the time. But I do have to say that that this is a good moment for democracy in Venezuela, regardless of the outcome. It could be a dirty outcome and they may not achieve democracy. But this is the first time that, let's call it for what it is, a socialist dictatorship, even a socialist government that has refused to accept the will of the people, is facing a serious challenge, the most serious challenge that there is, with a possibility of success. Other countries have come close, as in Nicaragua, but other countries are very far from it, as in Cuba, where the dictatorship is very consolidated. So to me, this is, you know, not a depressing story at this point. It could become depressing. It has been more depressing in the past. But at this moment, I feel a little bit more optimistic with Venezuela.
Latin countries have shifted, right? And that's partly due to Venezuela, isn't it? Because of
I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that during the 2000s, many countries had, in Latin America, had leftist governments, some more radical than others, but it was a more frequent type of administrations than not. And in the past 3-4 years, they have been switching in perhaps a pendular form. And one reason for that, it's not the only reason, is that Venezuela, as the leading leftist regime in the region, became very interventionist in the affairs of all these leftist governments, all of them. There isn't a leftist government that didn't have some kind of close ties to Venezuela. And those ties were pretty dirty everywhere. And the scandals
surfaced. I'm sorry, what do you mean by pretty dirty?
They were pretty dirty because they often involved huge economic transactions, either oil deals or trade deals, or simply transfers of grant money. And the recipients of these monies in all these countries used a lot of those funds in very non-transparent partisan ways. And when the region was experiencing an economic boom up until 2013, people were fairly okay with that, but now that the economy isn't doing so well and that there is more information about what these deals were about, people reacted negatively. And so leftist governments have been unseated electorally, and that has produced a shift away from leftist governments. There are exceptions, Mexico, for example, but in general, this is what is happening. And in many ways, the Venezuelan government is somewhat at fault for producing this sort of like right-wing wave in Latin America. It's a term that I don't like to use that much, but I want to use it simply to say that it's no longer a leftist ideology that is dominating most governments in the region. And in many ways, Maduro is paying a price for the foreign policy that he and Chavez conducted during the 2000s and 2010s.
Alejandro, how much oil has Venezuela got?
Oh, it has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. It has somewhere upwards of 500 billion barrels. It's an ocean of oil that it sits on top.
So what would be the impact of sanctions?
So sanctions have already been levied. This is one of the first measures that were announced by the Trump administration in the wake of recognizing Guaido as interim president. These sanctions basically freeze the accounts of Citgo and of PDVSA, which is the national oil company, and hold any monies that come in an escrow account basically until Guaido is either installed or through other mechanisms that money is it's able to be transferred onto him. However, there's been a new round of sanctions that have been discussed, and these would be basically the most severe sanctions that have been levied on any country by the United States and decades, harsher even than against Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
I hadn't realized that Venezuelan oil has been flowing into the U.S. for some considerable time.
Oh, it's been flowing uninterrupted for, you know, for almost 100 years. The only time that it's been stopped was during an oil industry strike in 2002 and 2003, which was promoted by the opposition. But Venezuela has been a reliable supplier of oil to the United States.
Okay, now let's go back to the other elephants jumping around the place. And I'll go back to you, Javier. The longer this agonizing process takes to reach some sort of conclusion, the worse things get for China and Russia, who, as we've reminded the listener, have invested billions in Venezuela in the hope of increasing their influence.
Yes. They have different objectives each. China is now thinking of Venezuela as, all right, we've put in so much money, nothing is working. Do we pull the plug or do we try to rescue? This is a typical problem when you put so much money in and you don't get the returns. It's not automatic that you are going to say, all right, well, you know, let's walk away. So they're becoming a little defensive, but they are fully aware that Venezuela is no longer producing the economic returns that they were hoping. They loaned a lot of money to Venezuela, and a lot of money hasn't been paid back, and a lot of the investments that have been made have not turned lucrative. So that's the situation with China. They need to decide whether to let go of some of the investments that they have made. Guaido has been smart, the interim president has been smart by starting to talk to China and say, look, we're going to respect some of these debts. So that is actually a very interesting line of communication. Who knows what's going to happen there? And Russia has a different objective. Russia really is in the business of containing the United States. And so Russia is perhaps, in my opinion, more willing to absorb more economic costs and perhaps become riskier because it is not necessarily trying to protect a large amount of investments made, but has already decided that it is going to use Venezuela as a way to try to create trouble for the United States. That is, a different type of game. On the other hand, Russia may conclude this is not worth the fight. You know, this is really not a type of strategic asset. And besides, the countercurrent is strong enough. The forces, currently Guaido is trending up, and Russia might decide that this may not be worth the effort. But I think, in my opinion, these are very different elephants, to use Alejandro's analogy, and each requires a different strategy on the part of the opposition.
Lefties listening to this program and conspiracy theorists around the world will invariably blame America for what's happened in Venezuela. I ask you this, Javier, is that fair?
You know, the United States has tried to intervene in Venezuela before in a much more aggressive way. And it didn't work, and it did a lot of damage. This was during the middle of the Chavez administration in the mid-2000s. But I would have to say that this current round, sort of like what has happened to Maduro, has been very much driven by home politics. That reporting that Alejandro was discussing at the beginning of the show has also revealed that many of these ideas and many of these initiatives came from within, not planted by the United States. In fact, in many ways, the United States, up until a month ago, was maybe being a bit conservative and willing to play the nuclear card. The nuclear card would have been the embargo that was finally declared last week. But the United States never did that, and the United States was playing relatively softly, I would say. So I think it's an unfair criticism that this is being driven by the United States. I think in this instance, the United States was driven into this conflict by domestic forces. This happens often enough in world politics, and this is just one example.
Gentlemen, I thank you very much for a fascinating encounter. Javier Carreras, Professor and Chair of Political Science at Amherst College, and our old friend Alejandro Velasco, Associate Professor of Modern Latin America in the Department of History at New York University. And I've no doubt that we will be talking again as the drama continues to unfold.